footage are we doing?
That's, again, that's misleading because that's the part that you see, which is the government creating credit to try to offset the organic economy that's no longer creating economic growth. That's the false signal. That's the Keynesian stimulus that came in 2009. The local government financing vehicles that went nuts borrowing funds that the municipalities couldn't. So that was the creation of on-the-books credit when you had all this other stuff that...
And it coincided with the NPVs on the investment, on the gross fixed capital formation, on the rail tracks, on the airports, on the bridges. They went from positive to flat to negative.
Right, because something changed. And it was really 2008, but really 2011, 2012. That was when the Chinese realized the situation had changed permanently. And that's really when the Japanese had already become...
Forgive me again, but I'm a Chinese bureaucrat. Where am I seeing it?
Everywhere.
Because, you know, like, their economy doesn't slow down.
Oh, it has.
But vis-a-vis the rest, but they really ramped it up. And they... Okay, so they came down from 12, but it was 8. And everyone was as, like, 1.
So what happened? You had massive economic growth in the middle 2000s, and then they had a temporary slowdown in 2008, and then they had a recovery in 2009 and into 2010, but it never got back to 2008. And then when the European financial crisis happened,
the growth never got back to it.
The growth rate never came back, but much of that growth in the 2010 period was from this artificial stimulus, forcing funds through, making municipalities spend and hit GDP targets regardless of how they did it. So you had low quality growth that didn't get back to the previous peak. And then you had the second crisis hit, which was not a European sovereign debt crisis, but another Eurodollar crisis in 2011. And then China really slowed down from there.
Which ended up being the sovereign debt crisis in Europe.
Which wasn't really a sovereign debt crisis in Europe. It was another collateral shortage. So you had a major shift in 2008, and then it caught up with the Chinese in 2011 and really 2012, which just happened to coincide with Xi Jinping taking the reins.
But you say, do you believe that it was pressure emanating from China, which reverberated back and hit and manifested itself as a European sovereign crisis?
No, I'm saying the European sovereign crisis is the one that caused the slowdown. It caused monetary difficulties that led to the Chinese economy taking a huge step backwards from which it's never recovered.
You're saying it created more risk aversion in the Eurodollar credit mechanism.
And temporarily, the Japanese were willing to supply.
So they stepped into that breach.
They started really in 2009. You see the statistics.
The Japanese were able to supply the dollars.
Yeah.
And that's why the
look at something like TIC, for example. Yeah. You see Japan is, you know, like this. And then all of a sudden in 2009, it goes parabolic.
Right.
That wasn't for Japan. The Japanese were sensing opportunity. They were the only risk takers out there.
Right.
They said, you know, the U.S. is screwed. Europe is toast. But China's going to be fine. China's going to be China. Look at Hu Jintao. He's still committed to growth at all costs. Look at them doing massive amounts of stimulus. Let's get in on it. Mm-hmm. So that's when, in 2009, is when Japan really got entangled with China. That's when they really stepped up all of
this.
Didn't Abe even go to China? And he did kind of that little detente referring back to the whole Nanking thing. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, and that it caused a little bit of a stir back in Japan.
Yeah.
But that was exactly it.
Yeah.
It was your conspiracy.
Yeah.
No, but that was... They decided that there's opportunity here.
Also, not to interrupt, because you're kind of flowing, but for people who don't know, Japanese M2 is twice the size of United States M2.
Yeah.
That's how much credit they
get. What, GDP?
No, just absolute
Just
dollars.
Absolute value?
Absolute
you
dollars.
Say Japanese or Chinese?
Chinese. Did I say Japanese? Yeah. Sorry, I meant Chinese.
Chinese M2 is about $37 trillion.
It's actually 40.
The U.S. is 81.
Yeah, it's 40. But yeah, it's... That's U.S. dollar equivalent. That's not...
But that's what I'm saying, but from 2000, if you look at the movement from 2008 to that figure...
Yeah. No, that's what I'm saying.
I'd love to, and I think we're trying to get there, the explanation of how that came about, and of course the consequences of that today, because you got $40 trillion, let's say, supported by $3 trillion of treasuries. And everyone's saying they're going to sell the treasuries to support the currency. Actually, do they have enough treasuries to support the money supply?
They don't, you know? That's it.
But anyway.
How did that work with the dollar? Cause I'm trying to think what the dollar was doing. Did the dollar spike and then come back down when Japan started to get involved with the game there as far as providing that dollar liquidity?
Yeah, so if you look at it from the perspective of China's yuan, China's yuan was, they forced the PBOC to repeg it through most of the 2008 crisis. Oh, it started in July. I mean, everything started, the global financial crisis really became global in July 2008. You saw oil prices start to come down. You saw the Chinese start to do things with their currency and other places around the world. But for the most part, during that immediate aftermath of 2008, 2009, China's yuan went back to its strengthening trend. Mm. Because that was the dollar inflow, largely from Tokyo, going back into China.
But that was one of the world's greatest macro trades.
It was,
because
for a while.
The U.S. had gone to zero rates, gone to zero. China had pegged the for best part of 2 years.
Yeah, they didn't leave. They were.
And so, you know, it was even more undervalued, if you will.
Yep. And then it popped.
And they popped it. They then, with the pop, they put their, you know, the currency is the daily movement is prescribed. And back then it was really, really tight. And so they defined the volatility. The destination was the currency was going to appreciate. Mm-hmm. If you were Chinese, the game was, I'm going to borrow dollars, sell, in, you know, and get. And so my liabilities, it cost me nothing. And it's my liability is going to fall. And if I can somehow get it onshore in the shadow banking system, I'm going to make 20%.
Yeah.
And I've got the PBOC, and there's just it's a
smooth function. There's no currency risk.
There's no currency risk. And so there's no variance in the mark to mark.
Yeah.
So the swap ratio trade on that. And what the PBOC discovered was the size of that trade was fucking enormous.
Yeah, that's probably what led them to finally say, we need to let the currency go. I don't think they were ready to.
They weren't.
Yeah, but they had to.
Are you talking in 2015?
Oh, this is 2010.
Oh, this is before that.
Yeah. But okay. Then the currency, like you said, it just went.
I traded it, I think 13, where they then came in, because they started, they changed the intervention levels, or the, what do you call it?
The daily band, yeah.
They expanded it, so they introduced vol. They're like, okay, motherfuckers, we're going to double the vol. Let's see what happens to your risk position. Risk position came down.
Yeah.
But during that period, the earlier period, that the hunt was trying to, you know, they were over-invoicing. The trick was, how do you get those cheap dollars onshore and earning 20%?
Yeah, that was the problem, because the Chinese officials would take, if you did it through official channels, assuming you get approval, the Chinese would just confiscate the dollars as an inflation fighting tactic. But that, you know, again, everything changed in 2011, 2012. When the currency began falling, I think it was January 4th of 2014. And it really hasn't looked back since.
And right about then, gold peaked at the 2000 level. And so the commodity cycle peaked.
I should note this and I just don't. Are there these nostro accounts between Japanese banks and Chinese banks that don't go through the official channel, and
there has
Japanese
to be,
banks extended dollar credit? Because that's what we were talking about the other day, that Japanese banks extended close to $1 trillion in dollar-based credit to China. Not China officially, Chinese corporates.
Those might be off-balance sheet, too. Off-balance sheet, because they offset each other.
But it's like
you said,
it's
a nostro, vostro.
You have, yeah, right, you have.
What is a nostro account?
It's like a way to settle just between. It's
interbank settlement.
It's rather than settling through the Fed, you just settle between yourselves. I owe you, you owe me.
But this is a central bank thing, or this
outside. It's correspondent banking. Yeah. Essentially, it's how do we transfer funds between each other without having to go through official channels? Because sometimes it's
how do we settle?
Right. And so the question is, you know, that's why I think one of the reasons why the Japanese were so central in that 2009 post period is because they had the contacts to go through Hong Kong, where they could have the on-the-books transfers, and then from Hong Kong into mainland China.
And that was a way to do it, too, without the currency variance because of the Hong Kong.
Are those accounts on or off balance sheet?
I think that from Hong Kong into China, I have no idea. I don't think anybody does. I think they're more likely off balance sheet.
But they usually on balance sheet, though?
I
think those would typically be on balance sheet.
Okay.
Yeah. I think because they would go through the
but if you're tracking the money trail, it kind of stops at Hong Kong.
Yeah, I get it. It stops.
Yeah.
You're saying normally.
I think that the money comes into the Hong Kong banks. They give them to the Hong Kong Monetary Authority.
That's one reason why.
Your account would be listed as an asset, and the account that they have with you would be listed as a liability.
That's one reason why. Changes left, but the only stock market I pay attention to is the Hang Seng. Because you look at the Hang Seng, and its movement is highly correlated with what I perceive of dollar flows from the stuff that I do. So if the Hang Seng's rising, that's a sort of loose proxy for excess dollars sitting in Hong Kong waiting to either go into China or someplace, coming out of China and going someplace else.
Mm.
That's why you see, like, recently the Hang Seng is one of the worst stock markets in the world right now because all the funds are leaving Hong Kong because they've left China.
Yeah.
Plus, it's the market's predominantly property.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's always important the U.S. monetary policy is like, okay, guys, we now need you to pivot. We need ZIRP.
And they're like, no, that's what they're saying, right?
On the other way,
maybe that's where the yield curve inversion is coming from, right?
Dollars are coming out.
Yeah.
There's an expectation from parts of the rest of the world where even if the U.S. thinks their economy is fine and inflationary, there is risk in China that could absolutely blow everything up that leads it back to zero interest rates and everything else.
Right, which is their interest rate to match the U.S. policy, and it's costing them more to buy the. They're using more of their reserves to buy the Hong Kong dollar, but there's no more reserves coming in, or there's no more dollars coming in.
But I think what Jeff was saying that, and that's kind of where that what's in play now is the consequences of the Fed being at this level and having no incentive to come down from this level in the short term. Is the consequences being felt outside the United States, predominantly China.
Yeah.
Well, Japan too, because they're...
Japan, Hong Kong, these pegs already. Yeah.
But this is why I... It's funny because you watch the Hang Seng. I watch the yen a lot. To me, that's the key to everything right now. And people have probably heard me say this before, but I kind of feel like whichever way the yen goes from here, if it moves in a hurry, either way, it can have really bad consequences because if it strengthens really fast, because they widen it, let's say the Bank of Japan widens the yield curve band, right? They probably won't. We can talk about why, but let's say they do. And then Japanese interest rates rise, makes the yen rise. The yen strengthens capital from around the world. It's been extended by the Japanese yen carry trade comes back into Japan. So now it's pulling capital away from all these emerging markets or developed markets.
Even treasuries.
And even treasuries that have been extended to. So now you're depriving those places of liquidity. And you've got U.S. rates are still at whatever they are. It just has the potential to be destabilizing. But the opposite, if it keeps going weak, it puts more pressure.
That happening? Because that's it's written in the newspapers. And I read it, I'm like, what a lot of nonsense.
Well, no. So this is why I don't think it can happen. So I try to, going back to your Bruce Kovner quote, which is great, by the way, and it's funny, it's so surreal to be sitting here with you, hearing you say that, because I used to read you and Bruce Kovner. And Bruce would say, to your point you're making earlier, he would say things like, I would try to figure out how corn can go to $300. Whether it will or not, I don't know, but I would try to figure out how it could, right?
That's like what I do on my whiteboard.
Yes.
Yeah.
So... The reason I think I agree with you on why they can't let interest rates rise is largely for the same thing that happened in the United States in March with the banks blowing up due to interest rates going higher. Because what I mean by that is the reason we had the bank crisis in March was that the banks owned all these treasuries, had very low yields, interest rates rose a lot, and that was fine because they weren't marked to market. But then when people started asking for their cash back, then they had to liquidate those treasuries at the market level, which was a lot lower than their held to maturity level. And so then their balance sheet was impaired. And then people wanted to take more money out because the balance sheets were impaired. And that same thing exists in Japan, except for Japan isn't holding low yielding treasuries. They're holding negative yielding treasuries. So a 1% move in Japanese interest rates, I think, would be almost as devastating as the 500% move in U.S.
because of the duration.
Interest rates.
Not only that, though, Brett, because remember, a lot of Japanese debt, some of the longer dated stuff that isn't owned by the Bank of Japan, is collateral for dollar funding.
Yes.
So that means we have to change haircuts for Japanese banks,
right,
which they can't absorb.
They can't do it, right? So I think if interest rates went up too much in, I mean, even 1% in Japan, I think they have a banking system crisis. Yeah. But I'd love to hear what you think.
The yield curve control has always been at times when the private sector wants to buy riskless securities. And so it kind of, it's always been the risk aversion of the private sector that's been the control part in the yield curve.
Yeah.
And it's just a coincidence indicator that bloody damn, feds are calling it, hey, we're controlling it. Like boycott, you should be buying the things that no one else wants to buy. It's not certainly not the case. So I can't, because to my mind, JGB yields have always been kind of the right side of correct. And today, they're the right side of correct, with an emphasis probably to going back lower again. I mean, that GDP, was it second quarter GDP?
Yeah, 6% annual rate.
Was the sticker, but the domestic economy was shrinking now.
Yep, at a 2% annual rate.
It actually shrunk at 2% annual rate.
Household spending was down pretty big, substantially. Investment was flat. So
if it goes back into deflation, then how do you get yen at 300?
Because then Japan's stuck. It's not just China anymore, it's Japan too.
Right.
Suddenly now we have dollar-providing activities that need to be funded for Japan as well as China.
And they're going to print yen to do it.
No, yen goes down as the cost of funding.
The yen going to 300 is a weakening.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit, when we were discussing Michael's kind of, hey, I've got a spreadsheet in the next 5 years, the US just blows up. None of the numbers work anymore. And, you were saying over breakfast, if we hit a hard landing, like 2008, and you were saying, so the Treasury has to come in and double what they did during COVID, but in COVID, they went 15% deficit to GDP.
Yeah.
So they do that. Now, maybe they do, but you'd have to be looking at the worst GDP contraction and absolute despair. But, I mean, 30s was Weimar. The Germans were 30%.
I think it was 60.
In 1919.
Yeah, overall they were 60. This kind of averaged out. But I would think that would be dollar bullish because of that crisis situation.
But that's, I think Brent hit upon it.
Japan, I thought that would be...
Yeah. But I think what we're talking about is a crisis of two stages. And certainly the one that I favored, and it's similar to 2008. So going in 2006, I was saying, if you think the future's inflation, you have to own 30-year U.S. securities. People are like, sorry, what? Again, irony and paradox. It was like something profoundly bad that shook the system to its core.
Yeah, which caused inflation, right?
Which is deflation, would cause a revolution in their intervention.
Right.
Now, the revolution was they went to zero and they created this new conversation piece called quantitative easing. It looks like we need that again. And even that was enough to take gold from 1,000 to 2,000. And then we just sat there for 12 years and gold constantly just being under that ceiling saying, there's no more revolution, so I'm going to kind of rest here. And so the third part of this Greek tragedy would be the third descent into maelstrom.
That would take you the next wave.
Which would be bigger than the ones that came before, such that, again, we thought 15 was the number of deficits to GDP. It's actually 30.
Yeah.
And that's the point where the whole thing comes apart.
That's why I was looking at 1940s.
Here's where I think it gets interesting. For me, this is where it gets really interesting, is that, and this is what I was, I guess, talking with Michael yesterday, is when you say that the U.S. is going to run a budget deficit of 25% of GDP, the number is so ridiculous that your mind just automatically rejects the idea and you stop thinking about it, right? But if you can push yourself past the ridiculousness and actually consider it, why can't it go to 25%? Why can't it go to 35%?
Yeah, I mean, you could have said this. I remember.
I'm
sorry. I just remember having a conversation with Luke back. Hugh's favorite, back in 2020 or something, the balance sheet of the Fed was like 4.5.
Yeah.
And we were like joking, like where we were laughing out loud that, oh, it could go to 10. And we're like, ha, 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 yeah. You're right. Yeah. Hugh's absurdity line.
Jets absurdum. What is it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Reductio ad absurdum.
Reductio ad absurdum.
Yeah, it was at that level. And then sure enough, we get to like 9
or whatever. Yeah,
I think one of the things we have to consider, too, is that, to Hugh's point here, the progression. The crisis in 2008 it created a major economic issue for the United States and Europe, for which neither have come back from. 2012 was sort of a waypoint to 2016. 2015, 2016, China was somewhat affected. They had, you know, they spent a lot of their reserves trying to fix their problem. But what really happened was emerging markets got hammered, and they've never come back from that. So what is the next stage in progression? The one place that has avoided being pummeled, and that's China itself. So we started with US and Europe. They've never come back. Then it got to the emerging markets. They've never come back. And now we're being told by the markets to zero in on China as the next one to fall under the knife here. So that's the
market.
That's the downside case here.
You're saying the markets are telling you that.
Yeah. And to what he was saying before, if you look at it from the Chinese perspective, where that actually plays out, that would be why the market is saying we gotta do something here. It's not about the U.S. economy. It's not about Europe. It's about this big giant over here in Asia that has managed to at least survive this long without falling into the same situation as everybody else has. What happens if China does become, if 2023 or 2024 becomes China's 2008?
Yeah, see, that's exactly what I was talking about today.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote that 10 years ago. I said, the U.S. first, Europe second, and then the final draw. The
final one was that, yeah.
Hugh, what year was it that you did your video in China? 2010, 11?
2009. So, and I'm glad you said that. So, let me tell you what that was. March 2009.
Okay.
And I
took. So it was the bottom.
That's what I'm going to come to. I was taking a slow train with two of my investment partners, and we were traveling the interior, and we went to Wuhan. We came in via Hong Kong. We actually walked over the border.
You planted it in 2009.
I saw that. I mean, it is the most fearsome, horrible, disgusting. It's like a scene out of Star Wars.
Really?
It really was bleak. And Wuhan was, Jesus, like...
The perfect place for a lab.
Enormous, an enormous metropolitan thing. And I filmed the empty...
Yeah,
the,
I remember.
It would have been $500 million in construction. It was empty. And I was drinking vodka on the slow train from Wuhan to Beijing. But let me tell you what I should have been doing. I should have been fucking buying the S&P. The bottom.
Yeah.
That was the bottom. Like March, April was the bottom. And so that's...
Well, you're talking about paradoxes. That's the paradox here, right? We've had a complete paradigm shift in the economy. But you have to be able to buy stocks because they've been one of the best performing assets over the last 15 years, despite the economy going in the exact opposite direction.
That's what I'm kicking with. I mean, I am not a Bruce Kavanaugh because of the error of being on that slow train around China. Because, you know, Andrew, you were saying yesterday, like, you know, guys, old bitch, I want to buy shit. I want to make money. But I'm in your camp, right? So I almost got it perfect, but almost just ain't good enough. Yeah.
Do you think if you had not physically been in China and having this like right in your face, you would have acted differently?
A little bit of that. But what I'm saying is, you know, 2006, 2007, I was, you know, accumulating treasuries. I was conceiving of the deflationary crash wasn't that hard to conceive of via the housing market, the teaser rates and everything else. It's remarkable how little people had invested in it. But I had that. It came good. And as it came good, we went again to touch upon yesterday. We briefly hit 4% or 3.7% real rates, real yields. Gold fell from 1,000 to 600.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm making money. I should be, and that was all it was happening. You know, we were having the kind of default crisis. It was, everyone was scrambling to buy the collateral, the treasuries. I owned it. You know, I was making $1 million per basis point change in the 2-10 spread. And it was boom, 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 boom. And Morgan Stanley were on the phone. Can we take the position off? I was like, go fuck yourself. But I did buy gold at 600.
Yeah.
Okay. I did buy the S&P, which had fallen, what did it fall, 60%, 62%?
65.
65. Yeah. If you can't buy the fucking S&P down 65%, if you can't buy them down...
You should just show your brokerage account.
You know, and partly that's why, don't I mention the DLTs, but that's a kind of... You're on a 3-standard deviation reversion in a global, the most globally important asset. And I believe you'll see reversion like we saw reversion in the S&P. So this whole debate is, and you know, Michael said, you went from houses, shitty houses being constructed around Vegas at a cost of $250,000 to construct, let's say, trading at $400,000, $450,000. Until they're not, they're trading at what, 60,000, 80,000, and then he wants to buy them, you know, and because you've had the profound boom closure of the speculative interest, and then you want to participate as the mean reversion takes you back. So we're all here looking for the awkward. We're looking for the things that can take that causes the mean reversion, and then we've got to step in. So for me, I've got my treasuries. But that's a trade. I want to make money as they mean revert back so that I can buy, maybe it's the S&P, maybe it's gold, maybe it's Bitcoin, maybe it's something else. That's the thrust of the thing.
You were talking about in 2009, you were already seeing empty buildings that have been constructed.
Oh, yeah.
So if it was that far back, what was happening there then? Why were they building like that and not housing people? Continues on until now, a year and a half ago, when Evergrande.
But a year or so later, that building was filled.
Okay.
You know, the economy, nefarious or otherwise, from 2008, the compound growth rate of the Chinese economy is 6.
Yeah, but it's much different
composition.
The first period than the second period.
Yeah. Why was it such a slow roll? This last year and a half, like, you know, watching the news 18 months ago, Evergrande explodes, and then...
But macro is slow.
Why is
These are enormous. This is an $18 trillion economy. The U.S. is $25 trillion. They don't just turn right.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of go... Or you watch it.
Well, Hugh, I thought it was the Chinese horoscope.
The Chinese horoscope
is... That's it.
It takes
slow.
Well, there's also... No, go ahead,
Jerry. I was just going to say, maybe you can chime in here. When you look at the inversion of the curves, just taking it so it's simple, like 2-10s, something like that, what we see inverted right now, everyone thinks that as soon as it inverts, then that's when the shit hits the fan. But you could tell me an average, I think it's the 18 months maybe.
12 to 18, sometimes 24.
Yeah.
The average is 18.
Or you get that 3-month, 10-year inversion, and that's how long it always takes. So people are saying, well, this time it's different because we haven't seen anything happen yet. Now, this is the
exactly
cycle.
Exactly the same.
This is how it works every single time.
There's some great charts that show that you take the S&P performance from all the inversion points. You get, like, you've had 9 inversions, maybe.
Yeah. Another interesting thing is I have access to all the archived editions of the Wall Street Journal going back to the 1920s. So, and I think you probably have this as well, but I go back and read the Wall Street Journal, like the front page, from like 2007 and even into 2008. And I tweeted out a quote from 2007, 2008, and I'm like, they're literally using the same script. It's like verbatim. I don't even think they've changed the article. I think they just changed
the author.
Changed the author and the date. Yeah, so... I guess my answer would be, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but historically, this is the way it always plays out.
You got to remember that things don't go in a straight line. So like you're saying, Evergrande failed in 2021, or at least it defaulted. It just this week, it filed Chapter 15 bankruptcy in New York. So there's that much time between the first default, and now Evergrande actually filing protection against its Eurobond creditors. And in between, what happens? It's not a straight line descent. You have Evergrande struggling to survive. You have speculators who are saying, oh, maybe this will turn out good. So there's always a back and forth that over time moves in a trend. And that trend takes time.
Foreign investment in that that would maybe have been hurt and they had an opportunity to get out or not?
Yeah, well, that's the last 6 months or so has been a complete battle because Evergrande and some of the other developers, because there's been a lot of offshore bond defaults from Chinese developers over the last 6 months, which is just happened to coinciding with all this shit that's going down in Chinese currency. But the Chinese, there's a lot of particulars about Euro bonds and how those, getting them into a Hong Kong court rather than a mainland China court. So there's lots of little delays. There's lots of little things that happen. Evergrande can find some funding to maintain its operation for 3 months longer to keep the lights on. So it's a long, drawn-out process from the first signal you get that something's going wrong to eventually, finally, it actually
happens. Same with Enron. Same thing with Enron. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, Curve and Bird during the GFC in 2006.
Yeah.
All 2007, the curve was inverted.
And there's all in a very macro sense, there's lots of things that can happen too, because we all have different opinions on things and how they're going to work out. So you have an initial shock, something happens, and some people pull back and it starts to look like there's a crisis. But then some people come in looking for the bottom and say, you know, this is going to be the bottom. I'm going to invest here. Yeah. Then there's another crisis and then it goes a little bit further and then more people come in. And you can keep this long, slow, non-linear trajectory up for many years. Until finally it gets to a point where it's just too far. So what we're really trying to, you know, struggling very hard with now, and all of us are, is where is that point where it's gone too far? Obviously we haven't hit it yet, but we're seeing signals from all over the place that suggest that it's more likely to happen than not happen. Yeah. What we've been talking about is how do we not get to that point? Is there an escape hatch here? And what would that look like?
When it happens, when you hit that one more, go fast after that, or is it still a long process?
No, it's Hemingway's bankruptcy. Yeah. Macro is slow, bloody slow, excruciatingly slow, and then boom. Yeah. You know, I made 50%. You know, I was in hell. I was writing my resignation as a hedge fund manager in late September of 2008. And indeed, I've been given a huge redemption notice from half my fund. I'm like, you know, we're fed up.
And then March or October, everything changed.
Yeah, I mean, I literally had dinner in New York with these guys who represented half of the fund. And I'm like, you know, because I could feel, you know, like, when did Lehman go? There was
September 15th. Yeah.
But when... Was that the Sunday when it officially went?
September 15th was the Monday.
It was a Monday, yeah.
Yeah. So it was the 13th when it actually failed. They had a whole weekend to try and sort it.
Because they're still, I made $200 million that Monday taking the kids to school, you know.
But even that. Hell,
and then, boom, it happened. It was in your face.
But that was, I mean, like you said, we've got the first curve inversion was Eurodollar futures in early 2006. And so we're talking about September of 2008 before finally everybody realized that the situation was completely gone. And you had the entire period. I knew in early 2007 when those two Bear Stearns hedge funds started showing problems.
And Bear Stearns in like August or September of 2007.
You said March 7.
It was February 2007. These two Bear Stearns high-grade hedge funds showed up and saying we're having liquidity problems. And that was like, holy shit. Something is really, but that was early 2007.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay. I thought you meant to, yeah.
And so we went for another year and a half with an actual crisis happening that nobody knew it was actually a crisis.
I'm thinking of is in September of 2007, HSBC.
BNP stole.
No, BNP was August 9th.
Their subprime, like, got way down.
It was their money market. The money market breached the
bottom. Yeah.
But even before that, what precipitated that was Merrill Lynch was involved in a collateralized funding arrangement with, I forget the counterparty, but they actually seized the assets. They were forced to seize these assets. These were toxic waste subprime mortgages. And they weren't really subprime. And what you do in a collateralized relationship, somebody defaults on the cash, you sell the asset to get your cash back. So they seized these assets expecting to sell it and get their cash back, and they got no buyers. And so everybody went, holy shit, because now we have a whole bunch of illiquid assets that are used as collateral that if I have to seize it, I can't sell it. And that's what really triggered the wave of everything afterwards. And
what was the phrase? Cat shit wrapped in dog shit.
Exactly. But the larger point is, even as that was going on, the general public would have had no idea. None. They would have had...
Well, Jim Cramer got Chris to buy Wachovia Bank in March of 2008.
That's right.
Yeah, it's like 16 years old.
So, yeah, and I think most people have this perception, you know this, George, that the 2008 crisis just, it happened all at once. It was fast, it was sharp. It's a long, drawn-out process, and there are a number of warning signs and red flags that go up during that period. And you have to be able to see them and interpret them and understand what they're saying, and then sort it all because you have tons of noise coming in from every direction. You have to sort through all that noise to find useful signals, which is not easy. And it's always open to interpretation, as George is always saying. You know, are some of these signals, are they what we think they are, or are they something else?
But that's
part of the reason why it takes so long to get there.
That's why I'm still searching for answers, Jeff, and having you in the room is invaluable. In that, you know, that 2008 point, I'm looking at Chinese M2, and, you know, to Brent's point, it's almost $40 trillion now. It's 2x US. They created a property bubble. The high mark in the property valuation was close to $60 trillion on a GDP of 18, so 3x GDP. How did we get there? And you were saying, was that Japan coming in 2011 and being that conduit of dollars? Because up until that point, you know, there was the money coming in from the trade surplus. And remember, the trade surplus was enormous. It peaked at almost 20% of GDP. Now, in the 1920s, when the US, if you will, was the industrialization that we've seen with China, and even more so, the rest of the world had been devastated by the First World War. The peak manufacturing surplus for the US vis-a-vis the rest of the world, or vis-a-vis GDP, but the surplus vis-a-vis the rest of the world divided by GDP was 6%. Japan, China got to 20%. Japan in the 80s got to, I think, 9%. Yeah. This is really an odd spot. So that money that was coming in was being immunized. The central bank was not, you know, it was being converted into red cabbage. And then the authorities had lending. There was a whole host of measures which controlled how much of that surplus liquidity could be converted into red cabbage.